Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 24th of May. This hour, we're going to look at the state of cable news. Our conversation in part prompted by Campbell Brown saying last week that she's going to be leaving her program. She said that when she accepted her job at CNN, she knew a ratings victory at 8 p.m. was going to be a formidable challenge. It is the toughest time slot in cable news, obviously, she said, due to the incredible talents of my 8 p.m. competitors. And her ratings were not what she wanted or what the network wanted. She said that CNN will have to figure out what they want at 8 o'clock. The 8 p.m. hour in cable news is currently driven by the indomitable Bill O'Reilly, Nancy Grace, and Keith Olbermann, she said, shedding her own journalistic skin to try to inhabit the kind of persona that might coexist in that lineup is simply an impossible task for her. It's not who I am, she said, or who I want to be, nor is it who CNN asked me to be at any point. This is the right decision for me, and I hope it will be a great opportunity for CNN. We have two guests with us joining us this hour, the first half hour of the program, Professor William Keith, professor in the Department of Communication at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and later Professor Robert McChesney will join us. He's in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and co-founder of Free Press. So all of you who watch cable news, this is your chance to defend the station that you listen to, or if you lament the fact that cable news is really much more opinion-driven and there's a concern about that, feel free to call us. Do you watch any? Obviously, you watch these shows. We all watch some of them. If we listen to public radio, we watch them and find out what people are talking about. Most of you do, I'm sure, at some point. Do you watch them less than they used to? Why do you watch? To reinforce your opinions or to be challenged by another point of view? We welcome your phone calls, as we always do. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, that's okay. That is talk@wpr.org. Professor William Keith, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Glad to be with you today.
Yeah, great to have you here. So do you think that Campbell Brown left because it's the only thing that will sell at this particular time is opinion-driven shows?
I think she points to a real problem. I mean, I couldn't tell you exactly what her motives are, but her analysis of the situation and what was hard for her are probably pretty much on target. There's a certain sense in which, I mean, you can talk about opinion-driven. Some people use the term infotainment for a certain kind of a news. But I almost don't want to just say that Olbermann or O'Reilly are opinion-driven. There's a sort of way in which they present news as a kind of drama.
Mm-hmm.
The old-fashioned way was a much more straight presentation with it left up to the viewers to decide whether or not or how dramatic things were, within limits, right? The news people did present dramas. But in this sense, the economics really work against CNN in general. It hasn't sort of positioned itself with a distinctive storyline. You kind of already know before you tune into MSNBC or Fox what the general outlines of the story are going to be. With CNN, you don't know what that is, and that's what makes it hard for her to compete.
So it makes, because we're so used to this high drama, does it make CNN dull, her show dull?
I think that is actually how people perceive it, which, I mean, it's kind of ironic because,
right,
you know, 30 years ago, CNN started out as the sort of national and respectable version of the local news. We're just giving you the straight news and we'll keep you up to date on this sort of thing. But with the diversification of the platforms for news, with different ways in which people can get their news, this no longer really fills a niche that's that important.
What do you think CNN is going to do with that time slot? Will they be forced to have somebody who's got an opinion giving that kind of show, high drama?
I think if they want to try to take some viewers away, yes, they're going to have to do that. If we were talking about prime time, I think they'd be trying to steal someone else's show. That probably isn't possible for them. But it's very hard within the framework they've set up,
yes,
that way in which they deliver the news, to make that switch. So they have increasingly sounded desperate about it, and I think for good reason.
So they might do an interview kind of program similar to Larry King, or it's hard to imagine what they're going to do.
It's very hard for me, because the problem for them at this point is if they try too hard, it's going to look ridiculous.
Right.
Olbermann spent a long time building his audience as a sort of counter audience to O'Reilly. And for CNN just to sort of weigh in with a big splashy program with lots of crazy drama, I'm not sure people will be able to take it seriously at all.
It seems to me, tell me if you share my perception or if I'm off base, that the more these people are on the air, people like Olbermann and O'Reilly, the more they talk, the fewer interviews we hear, the more special comments we hear. I used to be kind of a fan of a lot of this kind of television just for entertainment and, you know, to learn some things, to find out what people were thinking about certain issues. And now everybody seems to be so full of himself, and it's all guys who are talking nonstop, that I find it dull. I can't watch much of it anymore. What happened?
Well, the problem is, you know, you can say opinion-driven. If it's personality-driven, you either like the personality enough to tune in, or you don't.
Oh, that maybe it's a personality after a while. They don't grow, they don't wear well.
Well, I think this is the secret to their success, though, right? If you develop a kind of a dramatic storyline and a personality that fits into it, right? There's, to my mind, there's a shift in the role of the anchor. You know, the opposite end would be the way in which people used to view Walter Cronkite, as somebody who's sort of actively involved in promoting a given storyline. And people don't necessarily mind that. Because I think we have to look at the larger picture of this, is this huge diversification of sources. It's very, very important, because people can get different kinds of news in all sorts of different places, right? Because they have radio, TV, newspapers, and the internet. And the internet is accessible in many different forms in many different ways. So 30 years ago when CNN came on, you didn't really have that many places to turn for national news at any time of the day. Now you can go all sorts of places. So the niche has been filled by things which aren't exactly like just the news.
Mm-hmm. And then they make all of these programs, and it's true of local news as well, that it seems, this is an exaggeration, but almost half of what you're watching is special report, special coverage of some kind of event, and then it goes on and on and on and on and on and on. A couple questions. One is, does that kind of hype get people to watch because they're wondering what in the world happened? And two, do we grow tired of taking a certain event and just airing the heck out of it?
Well, obviously they do get viewers. I mean, in terms of where people get their news in the U.S., TV is still the number one place. The internet is now second. But I think some people do get tired of the, you know, sort of endless rehash of stories, the sort of scramble to create a media circus for something in hopes that somebody might tune in. The larger problem, too, is, you know, what does this do actually to the public discourse that supports democratic life, right? Because if most people are getting their news there, then is it really serving the interest that you want it to serve? Because increasingly, and that's why people want to talk about O'Reilly and Olbermann shows as opinion-driven, because they're referring, in a sense, to what role does this play in this larger picture. And so, you know, if you view it in purely entertainment, can you attract viewers by doing certain things? Well, they do a decent job of that. Are they doing what the news needs to do is another question.
What does the news need to do?
The way I want to look at it is that, you know, essentially the public discourse in the U.S. and any kind of vibrant democracy is an enormous kind of ecosystem. It has all sorts of different locations. It has niches. It has subsystems. And so it isn't as if there should be one news source. There's one place, right? There's many news sources. And any given person stands a particular sort of location within that larger system. And the evidence is now that people, in fact, are fairly proactive about getting their news from different places. They get some things from TV, some things from the local paper. They have, on average, 2 to 5 internet sites that they look at on a regular basis to look for national political news. And that seems to me, to a certain extent, to be all to the good. To a certain extent, if you put the whole sort of weight on the backs of the TV news, well, you guys have to do it right or everything's going to fall apart. That's a little bit unfair. On the other hand, if the techniques that they pass off as news, which may not be particularly like news but more like opinion and editorial, become absolutely standard, that does become a problem.
Mm-hmm. And have they become so opinionated that they're also kind of guiding policy. The New York Times had an interesting piece in April about Rick Santelli, who was doing that report on the floor, I'm sure you recall this, of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, suggesting it was time he really got into the story. It's time to organize a tea party to protest government spending on failed mortgages. And what happens? There's a tea party.
Well, that, yeah, right. So it was kind of interesting, right? There was a piece in the New York Review of Books last fall that claimed that the Tea Party was something utterly new in American politics. And some people objected to me, no, conservatives have organized themselves before. And they have, that's true. But they've never done it when they've been organized by a national cable news network, because Fox participated in that organizing. I'm not judging that to be good or bad, but as an absolutely new phenomenon, that there would be that level of connection. I think you have to go back to William Randolph Hearst and his newspapers to find that comparable level of connection between media and politics and grassroots politics.
Yeah.
So given that that's something kind of new, that also has to say, how is the entire system shifting in a certain way? And as a person who's looking for news, looking for reliable news that meets your needs, where does television fit into that? Where does the 8 p.m. hour fit into that?
Right. And then they spend so much time criticizing the people on the other networks. It just drives me crazy. What is the purpose in doing that?
Well, now that soap operas are fading away, have to go somewhere.
I guess. All right, let's get our listeners to chime in here. What do you think of the state of cable news? 800-486-8655. Jim in Galena, Illinois. Hi, Jim. Hi, Jim.
Hi. You know, I worked with the news media, and I was involved in politics in the 60s and 70s and early 80s, and I had a fairness doctrine involved in it, and the news had to be fair. They had to put an alternate opinion on, and they got every couple years the government come around or the individuals come around and ask you if they thought the news was fair. They dropped that, I don't know, 25 years ago, and ever since that's been gone, you got the Murdochs, you got Fox, you got Overman, and Glenn Beck. These guys can deliberately lie, and they have on TV. Misrepresent. It's not news. It's not news. They lie, and there's no penalty involved. There's nothing that they're ruining this country, and I mean they're taking this country down a path that it's just awful. And I've turned it off. The only show I watch right now is the Rachel Maddow show, which is basically at least she's fair. She'll put both sides on, and Fox News, Glenn Beck, Jesus. Why can't the government say, hey, you can't lie on TV and over me? You can't misrepresent it. It's not news. Until we change this, this country's going to be in a major problem. Somebody hears that on the news, they think it's truth.
Professor Keith.
I think there's a couple of really interesting points that the caller is raising here. The Fairness Doctrine related actually to broadcast media. Since the government owned the airwaves, they could regulate them to an extent. So it never would have applied to cable and would have been superseded now anyway. But there was kind of two different things going on there. In the sense of the Fairness Doctrine, you had to present the other side as if there were only two sides. Well, we kind of have that now, right? There's only two sides, red and blue and liberal and conservative, et cetera, and they're everywhere, but other voices are hard to hear. The other point that he brought up was they used to ask people about broadcasters, are they serving the public interest? Because they were chartered to serve the public interest. And that's a much deeper and more interesting question in some ways. And so he gets to it by saying, you know, well, if people are actually sort of outright lying. Part of the problem here is what counts as a lie depends on where you stand. Right? If there are libel laws and there are ways of punishing people who do lie in certain ways, but in many cases, one person's lie is the other person's truth. So it's very hard to adjudicate that. And what you need is a system large enough. There's enough things in it that eventually things sort out, and things that aren't true get pushed out, and things that are true come to the front. I'm most interested by why he likes Rachel Maddow. It's his perception that she's fair and even-handed. Campbell Brown thought she was too. Why does Rachel do better? That would be my question.
Hmm. And what's the answer? What do you think?
I think that a lot of the burden needs to be on consumers as well. There's an old joke that every society has the criminals it deserves. And partly it's true that every society has the media it deserves. If people stop watching, if people stop buying, then they will shift. If people demanded things that were honestly more fair, it would be different. So there, for the system to change overall, it can't just change on the supply side. It has to change on the demand side as well.
Thank you, Jim, for your call. Matt in Madison, hi.
Hey, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Real quick, I don't have a computer and I don't have television. I get primarily my news from you guys, Wisconsin Public Radio, National Public Radio, WRT, et cetera, and Democracy Now, what have you. I have seen these cable programs. I think it's hysterical, to be honest. I agree with the last caller immensely. And just a curiosity, what has these opinion-driven cable program shows done to politics? I mean, look at the past few presidential elections and what have you. And what has it done to the public view? And, you know, when is it going to stop? When is the cynicism and all the infighting? And look at it now. It's all politics. They just bounce the beach ball back and forth. And I'll take my comments off here, and I thank you.
Thanks, Matt, for your call.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting to me. I mean, one contrast you can draw along these lines is between the Tea Party and the Coffee Party, right? Because these are two sort of grassroots organizations that have sprung up, one in the last year, the other in the last 6 months. And part of what the sort of opinion-driven shows traffic in is not just opinions, but in outrage. And I think part of what the caller responds to is kind of ridiculous is, if the only sort of way that you have to react to politics is in terms of approval or violent outrage, where you have to condemn the other side in the strongest terms possible, that doesn't give you a lot of space to work. The sort of older style of thinking about, you know, democratic discourse was, well, you know, people disagree with me, but they have a point of view, and we should take it into account and try to work with them in this whole rational critical discourse business, which is easier to do face-to-face than it is in, you know, sort of 10-minute program segments on a national news program with one anchor staring at the camera. Now, the Coffee Party and the Tea Party are interestingly different because they have very similar goals in some ways and similar politics. People tend to perceive them as Tea Party is conservative and Coffee Party is liberal. But in fact, their positions, the things that they're angry about, are not actually so different. What is different is the Tea Party is about outrage. It's holding signs and marching and making sure that you show up on the evening news. The Coffee Party is about organizing face-to-face conversations between people who disagree with each other. The Coffee Party emerged kind of as a Facebook phenomenon, and there's about 200,000 people involved now, and they use their website to organize local community discussions about important issues.
Isn't it amazing to think of Matt there in Madison without a computer and without a television? I was just thinking about how life would be so different for me if I didn't have either one of those.
It would make me nervous, actually, a little bit.
I know, me too. I don't think I could do it. You have to do it. You wouldn't have a job, right? And I wouldn't either.
Yeah. Right, but also just that I'm not particularly trusting. I have media outlets that I like, but I consult others as well. President Obama, in the commencement at Michigan a few weeks ago, said, you know, gosh, if you're a Huffington Post reader, you should check out Bill O'Reilly. If you love Fox News, you know, you should read the New York Times. He's saying, you know, check out the opposing point of view. That's actually the democratic tradition. It's not easy. It can be uncomfortable. But you need to do it to have a full picture and to see the true things that the other side may have a handle on that you're not hearing from your side. I want to hear all sides before I make up my mind as far as I possibly can. And the narrower your pattern of news consumption, the more likely you're not hearing all sides.
Yes. Professor William Keith is our guest. Until about 10:30, he is professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Matt, thanks for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. And we also have an email, and that is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls. Judy in Milwaukee. Hello, Judy.
Hi. I'm another one. I don't have cable TV, but I have the internet, and I do occasionally watch Meet the Press or the Sunday morning thing. I don't get home in time to watch the news at night, And, of course, I watch public television, listen to public radio, read newspapers. I have a worry that I am missing something about the tone of this country by not listening to cable. And the reason I say that is I just got back from being away overseas for 2 months, and coming back here was just dumbfounded at the level of anger in the discourse and just the sense of being back in this country, so very different from being away. And I wonder if I'm escaping from that by not having those sources.
Professor?
Well, I think you do miss that right there. some sources trade in this, some sources don't. I also very much worry about the corrosive effect of endless anger. And it's anger that really has no consequences. It's very easy to be angry at faceless bureaucrats in Washington. And when you're confronted with the actual people and their actual policies, is it so easy? What you tend to notice is people in local political settings don't use anger in the same way. Because if you're on the, you know, sort of small town and you're on the city council and there's a dispute about, you know, where to move a road or something, and the person on the other side is somebody that you go to church with and your kids play on the same ball team and you have social relationships with, you're not likely to stand up and demonize them and say that they're the horrible person from this terrible point of view and all this kind of stuff. You're going to listen to them carefully. You're going to disagree. You're going to make your argument. And people used to think that there was a cost associated with hateful public discourse, and people who used it were sort of shuttled to the margins. If you go back to the 1930s and you look at Father Coughlin, he easily matches any kind of thing going on today in terms of his, you know, anger and ferocity and racism and anything you'd want to say. But he was shoved to the margins. As popular as he was for a brief time, he was never considered part of the mainstream media. So it's that shifting of boundaries that really seems like a problem to me, that really troubles me.
And Judy sounds like an incredibly discerning media consumer. She's watching intelligent programming.
That's true. Well, to a certain extent, right, she's watching programming that kind of meets her interest in terms of how do I want to hear the news told to me?
Yes.
Given that, it may not be the most complete, because I share the frustration of the last two callers. Watching Olbermann or O'Reilly is difficult for me now. Because, you know, I mean, Olbermann can be kind of funny sometimes, and so can O'Reilly. But a lot of it, it's just so hard to filter out the stuff going on. On the other end of it, there's also The Daily Show. And The Daily Show with Jon Stewart is a huge news source for a lot of people, especially if you look at the under 30 crowd. This may be where they get most of their news. What he substitutes for anger and outrage, well, he still has anger and outrage. He coats it in humor. And so it's much easier to swallow. But even as I enjoy his program, I realize that very much of the time, he's very angry.
He is also very funny.
It's very funny.
Mm-hmm. It is one of those shows that there's a lot of wit and there's a lot of research. I understand why people learn a lot about the news from that particular program. There's a lot of news in it.
The only thing I worry about with my students is a lot of them enjoy the program, but he assumes you already knew the news before you heard him mock it.
Yes.
And so if you're learning it while watching him mock it, you may get a little bit, you know, biased perspective.
What do your students watch?
For news? Mm-hmm. They scroll around to various sites, Yahoo News, CNN. A few of them go to the big papers, New York Times or Washington Post, but they generally go to the big aggregators. And a certain percentage of them follow Jon Stewart and the Colbert Report very closely.
Right. One more phone call for you, and then same topic, we're just changing guests here. Let's go next to Art from Milwaukee. Hello, Art.
Hi. Well, my radical, by the way, I get a lot of my information from The Daily Show as well. And it makes more and more sense as time goes on. But my radical suggestion to CNN is that they put CNN International on so people in the U.S. can see it. I can give you a quick story. As you know, we travel to Cuba sometimes. So a few years ago, we were going through Miami, so we stayed over in Miami. And they had CNN. That was, you know, three-quarters of the hour was about some woman in Texas who was pregnant and she had disappeared. And had she been kidnapped, had she run away, no one knew. Over and over again, the next hour, the same thing went on. Went to Cuba for a week, you know, had CNN International on in the hotel like you can get around the world. And they had real news, and then we came back, spent another night in the hotel in Miami. Same story, same. Nobody really knows anything about it hour after hour.
It was the same story?
Yeah, they still hadn't found her, so they were still spent over half of the hour, every hour, after hour, after hour. Well, we really don't know anything. Maybe she ran away. Maybe, you know.
Right.
You know, it was just drivel. I mean, it's a sad story for whatever her family was, but no news. So why should you watch CNN if you really want news? When they have pretty good quality international service that they don't show in this country, you have a pretty good cable option.
Professor Keith.
I absolutely agree in a certain sense, because everybody who travels abroad finds out things about their country that they didn't know, and they get a really different perspective on both our national and our international news. One caveat I would say is, if you treat certain kinds of news as this is good for you, it's like your spinach, eat it up, just do it, it doesn't get viewers. That's what Campbell Brown was doing. She was probably doing a version of the right thing, not the international perspective, but she was doing something better, but people didn't want to watch it. So the question is, could you come up with something which did have the vitamins that spinach has, but was so tasty people wanted to watch it? That's really the challenge for CNN.
Hmm. Well, there's a challenge. I'll have to think about that today. Thank you so much, Professor Keith, for being with us.
Thanks so much. My pleasure.
Professor William Keith, our guest the first half hour of the program in the Department of Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Professor Robert McChesney is going to join us now. He's in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and is the author of a number of books, co-author along with John Nichols. The most recent is The Death and Life of American Journalism, The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again. Our phone number remaining the same. Our lines have been pretty busy, but there is an opening right now, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, the email account is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Professor Robert McChesney, long time no speak. Hello. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Kathleen.
Yeah, nice to have you here. All right, with our guest just last half hour came up with a challenge. If you were to fill the 8 to 9 p.m. slot on CNN, and you were going to do a really hard-hitting, informative, excellent news show that had a lot of oomph to it so that there was a reason for people to watch it because it was also exciting, what would you put on the air?
Bill Moyers, probably.
He's not around. He's retiring.
I would put on someone who did journalism. I think, you know, I would put on someone who actually did value added, you know, because neither of the competitors to that hour on cable news do journalism per se.
Right.
They do commentary and punditry, but they basically, you know, Keith Olbermann's show, and it's a very entertaining show. I watch it periodically. He basically lists his program, his news stories from the internet or from newspapers. And likewise, Bill O'Reilly, you know, to the extent he does it, I don't know his modus operandi, but he doesn't have reporters who cover stuff. I think what you would do is break original news stories and on important issues like Bill Moyers does, and I think you would generate a very loyal, very strong following.
Mm. Why do you think Campbell Brown did not create that kind of following?
Well, probably I'm a case study for what she's doing, because I didn't even know she was on that slot. I knew she had a show on CNN, but I didn't know what time it was. Because if I'm watching news at that time, I'm probably going to watch Olbermann. Certainly didn't have the best publicity machine. So I'm not an expert on the content of the show. I've read a little bit about it in the news since it's gone off. And my sense, though, is that it really, what was the reason to watch it? What were you going to get out of the Campbell Brown show that you wouldn't get out of another program?
Well, I think that she was saying that she was trying to do a solid kind of journalism here, serious journalism, and she found that the competitors were what was the exact word she used? I can't find her statement because I got too many papers. But her competitors had this kind of pizzazz that she didn't want to have to do, and she felt that she was going to have to do it. She was hired as a serious journalist, whatever that word means.
You know, I think the problem she faced as a serious journalist trying to do is our serious journalism. Serious journalism, breaking stories, doing them well, costs a lot of money. And I think if you're going to have a very low-budget operation, and believe me, O'Reilly and Olbermann, except for their salaries, run a rock-bottom low-budget operation. Bill Moyers on public TV, for example, had a far larger team doing a weekly show than they do for their daily program. They had, you know, Bill Moyers had fact-checkers, fact-checked, everything went on the air. Obviously, that's something Bill O'Reilly's not familiar with.
Right.
And so, I mean, if you're at a low-budget operation where basically you're paying the salary of your anchor and a few producers and that's all you've got, you know, really the only thing that makes economic sense is to have an opinionated host.
Mm-hmm.
Because what else can you do? You don't have anything else to offer.
The other person I keep forgetting to mention in this group is Nancy Grace. Have you ever watched Nancy Grace?
You know, and then I've had to take a really long shower immediately afterwards.
I know.
It's an embarrassment to our culture.
Yeah.
She exists.
Right. And evidently doing very well. She's doing better than Campbell Brown is doing. I don't know. You know,
at the point here, I always get to that's really important, Kathleen, is that a lot of this is resource driven. If, in fact, you really have very low budgets, you know, with my good friend John Nichols, we went back and he was on one of his MSNBC evening shows a couple months ago. And we went into their studios and we were astounded compared to Bill Moyers' studio and staff, just how little resources they actually have. You know, you think MSNBC, it's owned by, you know, NBC, it's got all this money, they're rolling in people. It's not like that at all. It's an upgraded version of community radio almost.
Is it really?
It's really low budget. And I mean, the people are paid well, but there are very few people. So, and in the world in which they've gutted newsrooms to the point where there are very few actual journalists on these programs, if any, in fact, none, they're just producers who sort of scour the web for stories, you're really reduced to the point where the Nancy Graces and Bill Overman's and Bill O'Reilly's and Keith Olbermann's are what you're going to get. And I say that saying that there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I enjoy Keith Olbermann. There's nothing wrong with having a pointed point of view, take stories other people dig up, comment on them, discuss them. That's great. But if you're going to try to compete with that with what's called journalism, breaking stories on important issues that no one else is covering, then you've got to actually have journalists do that. You can't just sort of sit around and look serious on television.
Right. Well, the other thing that seems to have happened, and I think it's true of all the shows, I haven't counted how many minutes they're devoting to themselves and how many minutes they have the same experts on. All the stations have the same people on all the time. When you consider how many scholars there are in this country, that drives me crazy. But they seem to talk more and more and more, so that Keith is doing special comments all the time. Rachel, who I think is a very good interviewer, isn't doing as many of those. O'Reilly just keeps hogging the airwaves. I think that's true of a lot of radio guys that I hear too, and it's mostly guys who do this, that they can't have a show without their taking up 90% of it.
Well, that's the commercial model. I mean, the commercial model is when you don't do journalism, you don't do the resources to break stories with correspondents, doing stuff that no one knows, getting behind British Petroleum, for example, or really breaking original
stories. Right.
Break. Not that you get a leak from someone and then you report the leak, but you have to do
right.
the work. If you don't do any of that stuff, what you're reduced with commercial news media, what they're reduced to is punditry, opinion, and personality. That's what sells. And so, you know, that's why all the shows are packaged around a personality. It's not like a world news hour. It's basically the Campbell Brown or the Bill O'Reilly hour.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's really not, again, there's nothing wrong per se with that. That should be the cherry on the sundae, but that's not the ice cream. And what we really desperately need in all our TV news and all of our society is more real journalism, not less punditry, but punditry that's got more material to work with, so it's based on a stronger foundation.
Yeah. Maybe that's why it's become boring to me lately, that there isn't any based on solid information. It's much more punditry.
I think you're right, and I think also I get the sense at a certain point with all these programs, even the ones I enjoy, that they're talking to a fairly narrow group of people in our society. That, you know, those of us who are in that world, and I suspect a lot of the listeners are in that world too, if they're listening to this program, it sort of are concerned about public affairs, they're concerned about politics, they want to know what's going on in the world, are a relatively small percentage of Americans. I take no pleasure in taking, but I think what happens is that these news shows internalize the fact that they're really only reaching 2, 3, 4, 500,000 people out of a nation of 300 million.
Is that all?
Million.
Really?
Maybe a million two on the outside, and for O'Reilly, or 2 million. And even then, if you look at O'Reilly's viewership, it is overwhelmingly older people. His average age is in the 60s or early 70s. It skews very high. So, you know, in my classes, for example, Kathleen, I'll make a joke about Bill O'Reilly or comment about him, and none of my students even know who he is. They've never watched him. They don't take him seriously. I don't think anyone under 40 watches Bill O'Reilly, unless they're visiting their grandparents.
I didn't know that. Let's go to phone calls. We have a ton of people who are online. Emily in Richland Center, hi.
Hi. I am one of those people who fits into that under 30 age group who is very, very much gets most of their news from shows like The Daily Show and The Colbert Report. And one of the things, we talked about it a little bit, I'm actually in college right now, and we talked about it a little bit in one of my classes, that people who are my age who have a tendency to get their news from those sources, if they don't understand what's being discussed, that they will look it up on alternative news sites. And I think that's pretty much the only really good thing that's come from all of this punditry and television journalism, is the fact that there are people like me now who can watch the satire, and it's so engaging that it makes us want to research and find out more for our own personal enlightenment. And I think that's pretty cool. So that was my comment, and that's it.
Thank you, Emily. Professor
McChesney. That's a great comment, Emily. And I love Colbert. I think he's an absolute comic genius. I like Stewart as well. I think they're both great, and their shows are great. And I think part of their great appeal is that they do not have to go through with the conventions of professional journalism as they've devolved and deteriorated in the United States, meaning when they hear something that's patently absurd said by a politician, they don't have to report it with a straight face. So it means that, ironically, they're telling the truth in their journalism with comedy in a way that our conventional official journalism becomes sort of a mouthpiece for lies, because to follow its patterns and conventions, they have to take seriously what's obviously not true. And I think there's great value in that. But I think there's also grounds to be concerned, as much as I like Colbert and Stewart, the idea that comedians are the voices of truth and the official news can't be trusted. And I'm reminded of all people, Ralph Nader. Back when he was a young man just out of law school, he went to the Soviet Union and traveled around because he just wanted to learn what communism was all about, because he'd heard so much about it. And he said that he never saw such fantastic political humor in his life as in the Soviet Union. He said that it was absolutely biting. It was brilliant. And the reason it was so great and everyone liked it was that the official news, Pravda and TASS and Izvestia, was so horrible that it was the only place they could get anything close to an accurate understanding of the world they were living in. And he said, you know, you think about it, that was great that they had that humor, but it's really a comment on how bad the overall society was, that it required that humor to be the only place of truth. You know, it's not a sustainable model just to have comedians on a couple of shows be the ones who are telling us the truth or close to the truth on the world. We really need an official journalism that does a much better job.
I had no idea the Soviet Union was a hotbed of political humor.
It wasn't legally done, but I mean, it was a whole vibrant underground.
Right.
Of bureaucrats and communism.
Huh. Thanks, Emily. Bill in Kenosha, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Bill.
My name is Bill Tucker, and I'm a former journalism major, and I'm also a Tea Party member, and I'm a candidate for Congress in Wisconsin's 1st District. And I can tell you that I don't appreciate the blending of the lines between journalism and opinion. There's a distinct difference. For example, news would be the house is on fire or Obama's elected president. That's a news report. Anything that's an opinion piece should not be labeled as news, but should be labeled as political opinion. And it should be presented that way by the television stations. My other comment is, as far as liars on TV, you know, one man's lie is another man's truth. We have free speech in this country, and that's why we don't restrict what's said on TV. And that's my comment.
All right, Bill?
Bob. Hello?
No, that was Bill.
Oh, thank you, Bill. Well, this is Bob.
Yeah. Hey, Bob.
Those are good comments. I would say this, that the distinction between a purely news, objective, factual story and opinion story sounds great when it's like a house burns down versus what's your opinion on the Civil Rights Act of 1964. But actually, it's a much more complicated issue than that. It doesn't mean it's not as important as he says, but because, you know, how does someone do a very good news story on the financial meltdown without getting into the explanation for it, which is going to be controversial if you're doing good journalism? No matter how much you don't try to inject your own opinion, you're going to piss off someone in power, probably, who are going to accuse you of being opinionated. So good journalism, it's not as simple as that. That's all I'm going to say. And that doesn't mean it can't be done. It just means we have to be aware that it's a complex phenomenon. Secondly, as to the idea that one man's lie is another man's opinion, I'd say that typifies or sums up the crisis today we have in our journalism, which is that we've gotten to the point where it's a liar's paradise. Someone can lie with impunity. We're at the point now, and this is the most frightening point we could be at. It's the one that terrified the founders of our republic, and it terrified Lincoln, where basically you can lie and not get called on it in our official news media culture. You can get away with it, so to speak. And that, is, in my view, is a function of the fact that we've really seen a deterioration of credible journalism that is sort of keeping track of people to fact-check them, people in power. I think we should, well, certainly no one's saying you should shut someone up, but the idea that someone can just basically lie, continue and get away, that isn't something we should congratulate ourselves for living in a free society. We should be concerned about.
Well, yeah, that's one of the reasons that journalism exists, that television exists, shouldn't it? To hold people accountable for their actions, to keep our country running, to be functional democracy.
Exactly.
Yeah. Bill, thanks very much for the call. We have a lot of emails to Professor McChesney. What do you think of how Rachel Maddow broke the story on Rand Paul by exposing his views on civil rights? Was that good journalism?
Well, I think it was great that she did that. I think it's too bad it happened so late in the game. I wonder why, you know, how it was. We're going to wait till we got elected till we finally found out about this. It should have been done earlier. It shouldn't have been done by a national journalist. That's a story that should have been covered in Kentucky. But I think there's also an even more important story here, which is that libertarianism in our culture, because it's had so much money behind it by conservative think tanks and billionaires, has been given this sort of goody-two-shoes public image of, well, it's for women's right to choose. It's so people can smoke pot and grow their hair long. It's so people can do their own thing and tell it like it is. And it's all the sort of gooey good stuff of freedom. Who doesn't like that? But the seamy underside of libertarianism is the stuff that doesn't get looked at all by our journalism. And I think that rock just got lifted slightly with Rand Paul's election. Things like not regulating business at all. So, you know, not regulating airlines, not regulating oil companies to do offshore drilling, not regulating banks. That's the seamy underside of libertarianism. And that's the side that I think scares the bejesus out of people. But most Americans are completely unaware of the fact that that's more important than Rand Paul's positions than anything concerning civil rights.
We need to pause for just a moment and we'll return. Professor Robert McChesney is our guest this half hour of the program. And we're talking about the state of cable news and listening to you about this issue as well and taking your emails. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go back to phone calls. Stephen in Fish Creek, hi.
Good morning. I have two favorite public radio shows, On the Media and Media Matters, and I'm so pleased to talk to Robert McChesney. I download your show onto my Google phone every week to listen to it because we don't get it here in Wisconsin. And in any case, I'm a fan, but I also want to talk about the fact that I think this collusion between media and special interests isn't new. The fact that we have about five corporations, major ownership of all of the media in the United States, you go back to 1937, and I learned that William Randolph Hearst was behind the whole business with making marijuana illegal, and he was working with DuPont to protect his own paper industries based upon growing trees and pulp versus hemp paper, and DuPont had just patented oil-based plastic, and he wanted that to supplant hemp-based plastic, which Henry Ford built the first Model T out of. This kind of stuff is brand new. People didn't even know that marijuana was hemp. They went to Mexico and found this name, and then Hearst populated it, and then people made it illegal in 1937. Congress passed the laws, and they didn't know they had just made hemp farming illegal in the United States.
Professor McChesney.
Well, I think the point you're making, see, first of all, thank you for the very kind words about Media Matters, but I think the point you're making is worth remembering, which is any type of journalism is always going to have conflicts of interest. You have institutions, you have sources of support, you have forms of management, and our entire history of journalism is a history of that process, going back to the beginning of the Republic. And commercial corruption, powerful interest influencing journalism, is not a new thing whatsoever. And in fact, the era you're talking about, the 1930s, the first three or four decades of the 20th century, were in many respects every bit as intense as what we've gone through in terms of commercial influence over the news as anything we've seen in the last 10 or 20 years.
And it's funny he should mention William Randolph Hearst. Not funny, but it shows you the power of what press can do and has historically, because Hearst also, I mean, in addition to a hemp story, he was, I think somebody once said about him, never met a war he didn't like, and really helped to bring the nation to war, didn't he?
Oh, sure. I mean, these newspaper barons in American history were extraordinarily powerful figures. I mean, we had more than we had one president who was one, and Warren Harding was a newspaper publisher. And we had many prominent newspaper publishers who were, you know, powers behind the throne, so to speak. So, yeah, there's a great deal of power without a lot of responsibility that goes with being a publisher. It's one of the reasons why professional journalism developed in the first place in the first three decades of the 20th century, was to try to at least limit that power to give the journalism more credibility so you could trust the news and you wouldn't think you were just getting fed something that benefited the owners or their commercial and political interests.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email. David Madison is a longtime NPR listener. I find my stomach turning while watching the sensational cable TV news shows. I hate the if it bleeds, it leads mentality of these news organizations, because I truly believe we live in a better world than they report. And he comments on the repetition of the same stories, the same horrible breaking news, and all of that gets old real quick. What is unfortunate is just how huge a role these news organizations play in shaping our nation's perspective on our world's happenings.
I agree completely, and that's one of the reasons I do, because I share those concerns. I think news media are extraordinarily important for how people understand the world, all media are, but news media is sort of the foundation of politics, and so it's of singular importance. And I think our news media, commercial news media in particular, are failing us dramatically, and so we have to work on it.
Thank you for your email, and let's go to Joel from Pewaukee. Hi, Joel.
Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning, Mr. McChesney.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I wanted to know something we agree about. I guess I'd be libertarian. Your views tend to be more Marxist, and together we haven't been covered through the mainstream media over the years.
Why do you say his views are Marxist?
He's closer to being Marxist than he is to being just mainstream.
From what he said on the air here?
What's that?
From what he said on the air? I mean, where do you go?
Not from what he said on the air, but some of his published work. But let
which
me just
published
go
work
on.
Is this, sir? Sir, which published work is this?
Yeah, can you get to the topic here, Joel?
Yeah, let me get to the topic, because you said that Fox News only has, like, what, 500,000 viewers? All of the Fox shows get 3 million viewers. CNN gets less than 1 million. Part of what I'm saying is what's happened is the splintering of the news. When it used to be essentially a liberal echo chamber, and now anybody who has different views can turn to myriad websites, whether it be Newsmax, Breitbart. And I guess what I'm saying as a professor who teaches students, would you say that some of the news, such as what took place when O'Keefe went and did the Acorn thing, that wouldn't appear on any of the mainstream news, but it did appear in Fox News. Would you say to that student that that wasn't news he was doing?
Oh, absolutely. What that student did, now that the full story has come out, what that student did and what Fox did was reprehensible, because that student edited a tape to give a very misleading impression, and Fox ran the edited tape, and it gave an extremely misleading impression of what that student's experiences were with Acorn. That's been renounced since then. So in that case, had it been an accurate piece of journalism, Fair enough. But that was actually, this student now has already been in all sorts of hot water for ethical problems since then, trying to break into a member of Congress's office. So that O'Keefe story is one that Fox doesn't want people mentioning. So if you like Fox, I wouldn't be referring to that one again.
Well, and it also resulted in a cutoff of funding to Acorn, didn't it?
It was an outrageous story, because what the student did is, students might, people are probably familiar with this story, is he and his girlfriend dressed up like a pimp and a hooker and went around to a bunch of Acorn offices trying to get them to bite. But they were going to. Well, what they did that wasn't clear is they weren't dressed like that when they were doing these meetings. They dressed like that later, and they added that clip in as they walked to make them look like that. And then they edited it to make it completely differently, and Fox ran it as they had edited it. And they also cherry-picked out of a number of offices they went to, so they picked, you know, this egregious example they could find. So they gave the misleading impression there, too.
Yeah.
So it was something that it's not journalism. Mm-hmm. It was nothing that a credible journalist, whatever their political views had anything to do with, and anyone with Fox
would ever do. Yeah.
Would ever do it.
Professor McChesney, we're plumb out of time. Thank you. Thank you so much for being with us, as always. Thank you. This hour went so fast, didn't it? He's in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois, and we thank Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease for producing this hour.